Call your attention this morning to the Gospel of Luke. We will be in chapter 23 today. Appreciate Austin leading us in our Bible reading today. Chad is out of town. He went on an excursion that sounds nuts to me. He went on a hunt for wild boars and alligators. And he got one of each. He sent back pictures, and all I was thinking whenever he had the mouth of that alligator open, all I'm thinking is, I'd rather be golfing. And now, it was not like a 14-foot alligator. It's not like the kind Troy from Old Swamp People would have caught. But I'm going to tell you something. If he had chomped on you, it could have hurt. Now, I don't believe he could have pulled me in, but I wouldn't have wanted to be in the water with him. And my dad used to say that if you ever shoot a hog, you better have a tree to climb because he's coming after you if you don't kill it. And so he's had a good time. And my guess is he's going to be on baby duty. Isabella has been sick for the last two or three days. She actually has some pneumonia. And so when he gets back, it's going to be 24/7 for about 3 days. You know, or a week. I guess that's what the seven is. So 24/3. And so anyway, Luke chapter 23, the third message in our series on the way of suffering. Today, daughters of Jerusalem, weep for yourselves. We have witnessed six trials. We saw the three religious trials that took place with Annas and Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. We witnessed the civil trials, Pilate, Herod, back to Pilate. Well, now the beating is over. They have scourged him. They have beat him with the cat of nine tails. Blood has already been spilled. Flesh has been torn. But now they're leading him out of the city. On his shoulders, there is a crossbeam. Probably weighs somewhere around 100 pounds. And he is staggering like a butterfly as he goes through those roads. And as he's there, there are women that are on the side of the road. They're looking. There are men there, but the women are the ones that are doing the weeping. And so that's the context that we are looking at today. When we see what he's going to tell today, I hope that you understand that no matter the shape, no matter the injuries, no matter the poundings that Jesus has already taken, he cares for people. It was such an appropriate song, what Doug just sang. And so I want us to look at three things this morning. I want us to look, first of all, beginning in verse 26, I want us to look at stunned Simon. Verse 26 says this. And as they led him away, in other words, he's leaving Pilate's court, the little area where he has pronounced the judgment. They laid hold upon one Simon, a Cyrenian, coming out of the country. And on him they laid the cross, that he might bear it after Jesus. I want you to think about this man named Simon. What do we know about him? Well, we know from the accounts in all the Gospels, we know that he was from a place called Cyrene, and some people pronounce it Cyrene. Where is that? Well, it's in modern-day Libya. It's about 800 miles from Jerusalem. This man, at some point in his past, has brought his family, and they have come to Israel, and they're most likely living there. We know that he's probably, being from North Africa, he is probably a dark-skinned man. He may be black, he may not be. But I know that in that area, predominantly, the people are dark-skinned. And so you have this man that has come to live, or certainly to visit for a long time in Israel. We know this. We know that the man was a good parent. You say, why do you say that? You have one verse here that you've read. How do you know that he is a good parent? Because the Gospel of Mark tells us that there were two boys that were the sons of the man that bore the cross. You have one of them, and his name was Alexander. You have another that was named Rufus. And so you have these two boys, and Mark, the writer of the second gospel, he knows these men personally. He knows their testimony. If you keep reading through the New Testament, you will find in Paul's writings, you will find that he references a man in Romans chapter 16 named Rufus. Most people believe that it's the same Rufus that was the son of Simon. Now, I believe that this man probably had been converted to Judaism. That would be called a proselyte Jew. And so you have this man that had converted to Judaism. He is now living, probably working in the countryside. I'll say more about the countryside here in just a little bit. But he is working in this countryside, but now it is the time of the Passover. He's not working during this time. He just probably lives there. But he's coming in most likely to make a sacrifice during this time. It has been said by people like Josephus that during Passover, it was a very common thing for there to be 200 to 250,000 lambs that would be slain. There was a conduit that would come out of the Temple Mount, and it would go down and it would lead and run into the Kidron Valley, where there was a little brook that would turn red with the blood of those lambs. And so he is coming to the city. He is coming to offer a sacrifice. And so we know that he was a proselyte. We could have called him a pilgrim. You know that there's people that make pilgrimages to the Holy Land. That's a very common thing. You could say that the trip that we're going to be taking this fall, if things are calm, we're not going to go if it's dangerous, but if it's calm, we have 18 people, I think, that are planning on going on a trip to the Holy Land. That could be called a pilgrimage. And so we see that this man is a good parent. We see that he is a pilgrim. But we also see that he is now a participant. If you read again, it says that as he was coming out of the country, and on him, Simon, they laid the cross. What has happened? It basically seems to me that, just reading between the lines, is that Jesus, with the loss of blood that he's already experienced, with the beatings that he has already received from the cat of nine tails, the flagellum, if you want to use the Latin word for it, this beating has basically injured him to the point to where his strength, and let me tell you something, Jesus was probably a strong man. He was reared and worked in a carpenter shop. And so carrying lumber around would not have been a problem. But after the beatings that he has endured, 100-pound crossbeam across his shoulders would be a pretty heavy load to bear. And it doesn't say this in the text, but some people read and say he fell to the ground. And he was staggering, trying to walk with this crossbeam. The Roman soldiers were not going to help. They would not stoop to help a criminal. The only thing they would do was beat more. And they would beat until you got to the place of crucifixion. We'll get to that next week. And so you've got him as he is coming out of the country. And all of a sudden there's a soldier, maybe a centurion or a commander, saying, "You, right there, you help him." And if a Roman soldier told you to do something, you had to do it. How many of you remember that passage in Matthew when it talks about that if a man compel you to go 1 mile with him, go two. The man that's in that story is a Roman soldier. A Roman soldier had a backpack that would weigh 75 pounds at least. And he would have to carry that thing. And so outside of the Jewish cities, the Jewish boys would mark off a mile because they were, by law, they were to carry a Roman soldier's backpack. And so as they would leave, the Roman soldiers would say, "Hey boy, carry that right there." And that little boy would have to pick that backpack up, and he would walk a mile with him. And when he got to that rock or that tree that had marked that 1 mile, he would drop it and say, "You carry it from now on." Well, this man was conscripted. That Roman soldier looked at Simon and he says, "You carry it." And when I see that, my first thought is, that's his first encounter with Christ. It'll be an encounter that will make a difference. We know that because of what happened to his family. We know that because of Alexander and Rufus and the fact that they were friends and most likely Christians with young John Mark. We know this because in Romans, when Rufus is mentioned, "and his mother and mine," in other words, Rufus's mother, Alexander's mother, Simon's wife, was a believer. And she had ministered to the Apostle Paul so much that he called this lady his mother. And so we see that Simon, his life was changed. And so we see that he was just stunned. He was not expecting to have to carry this beam. But yet here he is, and his life was never the same. Now, can I ask you to visualize him carrying that? He has this crossbeam, and he's carrying it, and he's probably now having the butterfly move. He's the one that's trying to get it to Golgotha. Can you picture him carrying that and understand that that's you and me? Are we not to carry our cross? Do we not have burdens that we have to bear? And can I tell you that one of the things that you and I must bear if we name the name of Christ, we must bear the name of Christ. And there's a lot of people that don't like him. Jesus said, "Marvel not if they hate you, they hated me before you. Yea, all those that live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution." If you want to start a riot, go to some public place and just start talking about Jesus. Jesus is the only way. What are you, a bigot? What are you, prejudiced? No, I'm just biblical. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by me." I just am narrow as the Bible is narrow. And so you've got this man that is stunned, but he's a picture of us. The second thing that I want you to see is beginning in verse 27. I want you to see sorrowful sisters. Now you say, what do you mean sisters? You'll see it in a second. Look at verse 27. "And there followed him a great company of people." In other words, it's not just women right now, but there's men in the great company. And of women. So that's why I know that there's men, probably some kids in this crowd. But these women are a special type of woman. These are women which also bewailed and lamented. In other words, they were weeping and wailing. They were loud. They're crying out loud. It's not a subtle cry. It is a deep cry that's coming from deep within inside of them. And so he looks at them and he says to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children." That is a strange thing for somebody in the shape that Jesus is in. As he's staggering, Simon behind him, carrying the crossbeam. And all of a sudden, on the sides, as he looks, he sees these women, and they are crying. And he stops, and he turns to them, and he says, "Daughters of Jerusalem." What does that phrase mean? Well, here you have these ladies, and they're professional mourners. In the Old Testament, you find them in numerous places. The phrase "daughters of Jerusalem" is found in several Old Testament books. It's found predominantly in the Song of Solomon. But you find it in other places. Sometimes they're not called daughters of Jerusalem. They're called daughters of Zion. These are the women that basically they came out of Judaism. When you think of Jerusalem, I want you to think of a mother. So you've got these ladies that are professional mourners. They have an empathy. They can sympathize with people. And here they have this young rabbi, this young man that they have only known to do good. This man that had gone through the Galilee, and now he is here in Jerusalem. But everywhere he went, blind people saw, deaf people heard, mute people spoke, dead people were raised. All of these people that were possessed of demons, cast out and made whole. All of those things this young man did, and now he's about to die. And so when I think about who these women are, they're professionals. But can I tell you that there is a group that followed him all the way from Galilee? Verse 49 tells us that. There was a group of women that followed Christ from up north into Jerusalem. We read that in verse 49. It says that they looked upon him from afar off. They were distant. Perhaps they were from here to the front doors. But they could see him. And I think that they were a part of these daughters of Jerusalem. You say, why does that? Jerusalem and the Galilee, they're not geographically together. I know, but there's a second interpretation. It's not just these ladies that were the mourners. It's not just these that could be called together and they would gather at a certain time when the procession was coming by and they would weep and they would wail. But there is a second interpretation, and this is where I want us to go now. I want you to look at Jeremiah, and I'll read verse 17, but 18, you could look at it as well. He says, "Followers of Jesus from the Galilee," in verse 49, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider ye and call for the mourning women." Not mourning like getting up in the morning, but mourning as in sorrowful. "That they may come and send for the cunning women, that they may come." And it goes on to talk in verse number 18 about how that these women are going to weep. Why is that? Because they're daughters of Jerusalem and trouble is coming. Now I want you to look at the next slide. I want you to notice, and I don't know what happened, but you see there's a big square there, and all of those on my computer, it's different. So I'm going to have to walk you through this. You're right, my left. All right. On the far right, you notice there is a square that's there that has nothing in it. It's supposed to have something in it. It's supposed to say Jerusalem, Mother City. All right? So in your mind, I want you to write, there we go. Okay. Just ask and it shall be done. All right. So what you see is, you see that Jerusalem is the mother city. But she has daughters. You see, there are many, many times in the Bible when a city is named, it is named in the feminine. You say, why is that? Have to ask the Lord about that. I have no idea. But I want you to see that all of those little daughters that are all around, you know what that is? That's towns. That's villages. If you were to leave Jerusalem, you could go just a couple of miles and you could come to a place called Bethany. That's a daughter of Jerusalem. You could go 6 miles and you would come to a place called Bethlehem. Sometimes at Christmas time, I preach on missing Christmas, 6 miles from Christmas. And so you have these daughters, all of these little hamlets, all of these little villages, the same place that Jesus would travel and heal people, proving that he was Messiah. And so when he says, daughters, don't weep for me. He's the one that's been beaten. He's the one that has been pummeled and beaten with a cat of nine tails, which was a whip that had nine tentacles on it. And there would be bone. And there would be sharp objects like metal. And it would rip the skin. And yet here Jesus, in all of the agony that he is having and is going to have more, he says, don't weep for me. Now, why is that? Because there's an enemy that is coming. And this enemy is going to pick those daughters off one at a time. He says, don't just weep for me, weep for your children. And so you've got these daughters of Jerusalem, which could be the daughters that were the women of the city. It could be those that came out of the Galilee and now they have joined with the weeping widows in the streets of Jerusalem, those daughters of Jerusalem. It could be that these are the people that are in the cities, the little townships that are outside the walls of the mother city. Now, around every major city, does not matter in those ancient times, does not matter. If you're talking about Nineveh, it had a wall. If you're talking about Babylon, it had a wall. If you're talking about Jerusalem, it had a wall. The old city of Jerusalem, there was a wall around it. There's the newer cities, there's walls around it. And so every one of these ancient cities, there would be a wall that would be there, and it would offer for protection the people that were inside. But for those daughters that were outside the walls, there was no protection. Absolutely none. When those armies would roll in, whether it would have been the Assyrians or whether it had been the Babylonians, whether it was the Greeks, whether it was the Persians, or now the Romans, there was no protection for those daughters that were outside the walls of that city. Now, I want you to think about this in the compassion of Jesus. When he uses that term, daughter. I have two wonderful, wonderful daughters. Those girls have been tremendous blessings to me and my wife. I mean, they have helped her when she was sick. When I have needed them to do something, they have been there. And they continue to do that. There is something that is special about daughters. A daughter that is the right kind of daughter is a blessing 1,000 times over. I heard of a man one time, he had 2 boys. And they didn't really come around him a whole lot. His wife had already passed on. And he told one of our men one time, he said, I'd swap both my boys for 2 girls right now. I understand that sentiment exactly. And so you've got Jesus and his compassion. And he looks at them and he says, daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. Now I want to challenge you to do something. I challenge you, read your Bible. And at any time in the Gospels that you can read, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, any one of the 4. I challenge you to find any instance where a woman ever opposed the ministry of Jesus. You don't find one. Can I tell you that there is a certain intuitiveness that women have that men do not? Sometimes we men charge in where angels fear to tread, where if we would have just listened to our wives, it would have been better. And these women, they followed Christ all the way from the Galilee, and probably even many of those that were in Jerusalem, they had seen what he had done, and intuitively, they knew that Jesus was Messiah. Now, the men didn't know it. These women, they were really not thought of very much. The Gentile countries and men, basically, they treated women much like cattle. The Jews were not much better. Did you know that in a court of law, that a woman's testimony was about like that of a shepherd? That was not very highly regarded. Oh, but when Jesus came along, what did he do? He elevated the status of women. You think about this. Who were the ones that Jesus showed himself to? After his resurrection, the very first person that he showed himself to was a woman that had demons cast out of her, Mary Magdalene. You think about the people that he bragged on. This will be a memorial for her from now on, about Mary of Bethany when she anointed him for the burying. And throughout the Bible, you see that women are elevated. Now, there are people that claim that Christ is a misogynist and that God is a misogynist and that women are not valued at all. That is a million miles from what the Bible teaches. And so you have these daughters of Jerusalem, and they're going to have enemies come. And it's coming soon, which brings me to our last point. There's sobering statements that Jesus gives to them beginning in verse 29. And in verse 29, he says this, "For behold, the days are coming." He didn't say may come. They are coming. "The days are coming in which they shall say, blessed are the barren." What is a barren person? He's talking to the daughters here. A barren woman is a woman that has not been able to have children. Not only could they not have children, but he also reiterates that by saying, and the wombs that never bear, and the paps that never gave suck. In other words, the women that have never given birth, that have never had to deal with a newborn infant breastfeeding, they are going to be better off than those that have. Why is that? Because the enemy's coming. Destruction is coming. They're going to begin to say things like this. Mountains, fall on us. Fall on us. And so Jesus is saying, weep for yourselves. And they're probably thinking in their mind, but you're about to die. And Jesus is saying, I know that. But I'm telling you, there's coming a time when you're going to have trouble like this. And it's going to be all of you, not just one person. So what do we see? We see a prophecy. We'll close in a moment with a proverb. But the prophecy is the one that the days are coming when they will say, blessed are the barren. So what is that a reference to? Well, I think that it's a reference to something that's going to happen in about 66 A.D. In 66 A.D., there was a revolt. The Jews decided that they were not going to be under Roman rule any longer. from 63 BC in Pompeii, or some people call him Pompey, all right? I've always said Pompeii, and it's hard to change when you're 69. In 63 BC, Pompey defeated the Jews, and Rome basically began to rule. But in 66 AD, so we're talking 120 years, Rome has had enough of these skirmishes. They're done. What was the powder keg that got ignited? Well, Rome had a little garrison that was at Jerusalem. Not a very big presence, but they were there. And the Jews decided, you know what, we're done. And so they killed the garrison of Roman soldiers. So they're feeling their oats a little bit. Well, was it long before there was a larger garrison of soldiers that came out of Syria, which was under Roman control? It's a little larger than the small garrison that they had at Fort of Antonia. So they come in, and the Jews defeat them. And they're now going, yeah, we're good. Everybody needs to get on board with this rebellion. We are going to defeat and throw off the yoke of the Romans. The problem was the Romans didn't get the message. And so they came in the third time in 66. They came in with 60,000 trained soldiers. These were not just some guy that they, you know, said, hey, we'll give you, you know, 5 pounds of salt every week. They paid them in salt in those days. No, these guys were the professionals. These were the guys that could kill you six ways from Sunday. And there was 60,000 of them. And what did they do? As they came in, Karen, can you go back to the picture of the diagram? There you go. That enemy was coming in. And they would take this daughter and they would be annihilated. They would take another daughter and annihilate that little town. And finally, they laid siege to Jerusalem. They put a siege. They put a wall of soldiers all the way around that ancient city. And they laid siege to it, and it had gotten so bad. And the Jews thought they were okay because they had put grain up. But the problem was, the zealots, the Jewish zealots, they burned the grain to try to force everybody to join the revolt, and they had nothing to eat. Did you know that in Deuteronomy, I think it's chapter 23, in Deuteronomy chapter 23, it says that it's going to get so bad prophetically that the men and women are going to eat their offspring. They're going to resort to cannibalism. There's nothing to eat. And so you have these kids that have died, and so eating. And somebody will come along and they'll say, give me some. No, you're not getting my son. You're not getting my daughter. And the siege had gotten so bad that they were cannibals. Josephus says this. He says that when this siege was over in 70 and Jerusalem fell, and the prophecy that Jesus had given about the temple, every stone being cast down, that had been fulfilled. The history was written that there were over 100,000 Jews that had been killed by the Romans or sold into slavery by the Romans. That was the prophecy. But can I tell you, there is a far prophecy? In the Bible, there is an understanding, there is a truth that there are times when the prophecies that are given is a near and then there's a far. The Bible tells us in Revelation chapter 16, that these people that are saying in verse number 30, fall on us and to the hills cover us, that is exactly what the people in Revelation 16 are going to be begging for. It is going to be so horrible. The tribulation period is going to make the Holocaust look like a Sunday school picnic. And we know that in World War II and with Hitler and all of the Nazis and how that they killed 6 million Jews, we know that we see these emaciated figures. And when I visited the Holocaust Museum in Israel, I could only go through about a half of it. I mean, when I walk by and I see like tennis shoes that are just stacked there by the hundreds under a bridge, that was literal shoes that children had taken off of them as they were sent to the gas chamber. And it was emotionally so charged that I really could not even go through the whole thing. And so you have this tribulation, it's going to be worse than that. And so there is a near and there is a far application. And these people are going to cry to the mountains, fall on us. Get us out of this misery. They want to die. But the Bible also says that death will flee. And so you and I, we see that prophecy that's there. Hosea was probably the first one to use that imagery when he said it in, I think it's chapter 10. And so you've got them saying, fall on us, fall on us. But there's a proverb, and with this I'll be done. Look at verse 31. For if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry? What does that mean? Well, this is a proverb that we would simply say it's a much more proverb. In other words, if in a green situation, it's going to be hard to fire it, how much more when everything's dried? Now, one of the things that I used to do as a kid, I used to like to camp. I had a cousin named Roy. Roy died when he was like 42. And Roy, he was a couple of years older than me, but he was fun to hang out with. He was a heathen and so was I. But one of the things that we like to do is we like to go camping. And his folks had a little bit of acreage. My Uncle Leroy and my Aunt Joyce, they had some acreage out behind their house. And so we would get us a little knapsack and we would put some pork and beans in it and we would put an onion in it. And so we would get out and we would empty the pork and beans and chop up the onion and we would put it over a fire that we had started. Did you know that it's easier to start a fire with dry wood than it is green? Now you can force a green one to burn, but it never burns hot the way that a dry will. And so the proverb is this: for they do these things in a green tree. In other words, the people that are taking you to my death right now. You see, Jesus is that green tree. He's done nothing. He's not dead. He's got righteousness. He is good. But they're going to force the situation. But there's coming a day when the dry is going to burn hotter than that green ever thought about. And that's why Jesus said, weep for yourselves and for your children. Don't weep for me. Because it's going to be worse on all of you than it is for me. You see, Jesus came to die. And the very warning that Jesus gave to these women, daughters of Jerusalem, Don't weep for me. Weep for yourselves. In other words, pay attention to what's happening. You need to listen the way that Simon was going to listen. You need to listen the way that the women out of the Galilee have listened. You need to listen. And so even those beautiful words, daughters of Jerusalem, was an invitation for Jesus, or to come to Jesus for salvation. And so you've got old Simon. His sweet wife came to Christ. His two boys came to Christ. They got involved in the church at Jerusalem. Their names are mentioned in the New Testament, at least Rufus and the mom. And so you have those people, and they took advantage of what they saw. Now the question is this: what about you? Have you ever come to Christ? I'm not talking about being born in a Christian family. I'm talking about being born again. You can be born in a Christian family. That does not make you a Christian. I've had people tell me, well, certainly I'm a Christian. I was born in America. And I'm like, boy, that sure don't cut it these days. But even in back in the days, whenever they would say that, and we were a halfway Christian nation, you still didn't get saved that way. When my children were small, I brainwashed them every night. You say, what do you mean by that? We prayed every night. And even when they were little, I'm talking about AJ size, which is my next to the youngest grandkid. Charlie, who's the youngest, he don't have a clue yet. But AJ's beginning to pick up on things. And when my three children were that small, at night, I would go and I would sit there on the edge of their bed. And I just prayed a little simple prayer that you know. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. But then I would brainwash him by saying this. I'd add a little addendum to it. And Lord, when I'm old enough to understand, I want you to save me. You say, why did you do that? Because I want my kids to be saved. And I have prayed that prayer with my older grandkids, and I will do it with these younger ones. Why? Because I want them to know Jesus. He is the way. He is the truth. He is the life. Nobody comes to the Father except by Him. So what about you? What are you trusting to take you to heaven? It wasn't long ago I was witnessing to a man, and I said, would you tell me, if you were to stand before Jesus right now and Him say, why should I let you into heaven? What would you say? He said, well, I'm trying to do better. I'm trying to be a good man. And I said, that is exactly wrong. And he looked. I said, that is the wrong answer. You cannot be good enough to save yourself. You may be a better person morally than I've ever dreamed about being. You may be a better woman than anybody that you've ever met, but you're still short of the glory of God. You're closer to being an awful sinner than you ever thought about being to God. So what about you today? Are you like these daughters of Jerusalem that were probably very religious? Are you like Simon that was a religious man? I mean, he had turned into a proselyte Jew. He had actually moved and was living probably outside of the city. And on those holy days, he's right there giving sacrifice. Why? Because he's got a desire for God. Maybe that's you, but you've never been born again. Jesus is offering you the opportunity today. I hope that you will come because you can.